In the fall of 1960, the writer and Nobel Prize for Literature recipient John Steinbeck set out from his home in Sag Harbor, Long Island on a cross-country trip in a brand spanking new GMC pickup truck he'd purchased with a camper unit attached to the truck bed. His sole traveling companion was his dog, Charlie. Several months earlier, Steinbeck had suffered a heart attack and a mild stroke, and he made this trip against the wishes of his wife and close friends. But he figured it might be his last crack at seeing once again, up close and personal, the America that he both loved and had strongly challenged in the years he'd spent getting to know its people and its land and writing about them. He named his pickup camper Rocinante, which is the name of the horse of Miguel Cervantes' satiric anti-hero, Don Quixote de La Mancha. 2 years later, Mr. Steinbeck's account of his journey was published in, I believe it was his last full-length work called Travels with Charlie. There's any number of passages I could read from this book that would serve as a lead-in to my topic for this morning, so I'm going to go with this one from the early stages of Steinbeck's journey. It's a few paragraphs after he's left the East Coast of New England and is coming into the Midwest. Since I hadn't seen the Midwest for a long time, many impressions crowded in on me as I drove through Ohio and Michigan and Illinois. This is 1960. The first was the enormous increase in population. Villages had become towns, and towns had grown to cities. The roads squirmed with traffic. The cities were so dense with people that all attention had to be devoted to not hitting anyone or not being hit. The next impression was of an electric energy, a force, almost a fluid of energy, so powerful as to be stunning in its impact. No matter what the direction, whether for good or for bad, the vitality was everywhere. I don't think for a second that the people I had seen and talked to in New England were either unfriendly or discourteous, but they spoke tersely and usually waited for a newcomer to open conversation. Almost on crossing the Ohio line, it seemed to me that people were more open and more outgoing. The waitress at a roadside stand said good morning before I had a chance to. Discussed breakfast as though she liked the idea. Spoke with enthusiasm about the weather. Sometimes even offered some information about herself without my delving. Strangers talked freely to one another without caution. I had forgotten how rich and beautiful is the countryside. The deep topsoil, the wealth of great trees, the lake country of Michigan, handsome as a well-made woman and dressed in jewel. It seemed to me that the earth was generous and outgoing here in the heartland, and perhaps the people took a cue from it. One of my lifelong fascinations has been with what I call the writer's or the artist's conscience. That is to say, the ability of certain persons to see and convey by word and image the same things we all see, but don't notice in quite the same way that they do. Whenever I drive across the Midwest, I'm usually just subtracting the miles and calculating the time involved until I get to wherever it is I'm trying to get. But with Steinbeck, it's the deep topsoil, the wealth of great trees, the lake country of Michigan, handsome as a well-made woman, dressed in jewel. It seemed to me that the earth was generous and outgoing here in the heartland, and perhaps the people took a cue from it. He connects, that is, a generous and outgoing earth with the spirit of the people who inhabit it. Steinbeck then was able to see something different, something contained within as well as beyond the ordinary, in a landscape that was seen by millions of others. And he could convey that difference with his gift of language, which is why he was a great writer. And most of the rest of us are who we are. I've made enough stabs at writing myself to know that I do not adequately possess this writer's or artist's consciousness. Certainly not at the level of those who really have it. But I believe there is, I believe there is a parallel between this trait and what I call a religious or spiritual consciousness. And I think, at least I hope at this point in my life, that I might have had some experience with this way of seeing and experiencing things. Maybe I can even convey a little bit of that, but I'm going to let you be the judge of that. So with all this as a backdrop, the question I want to put forth today is, what's the difference? By this I mean, what is the difference in being a person of faith in a liberal religious community and tradition like ours, or like the one that we are trying to be? What difference does it make in terms of how we see ourselves as individuals, as persons in community with one another, as well as the difference in how we see our larger world and our relationship to it? I'm going to be devoting two sermons to this topic. The one today will focus on how we answer that question more on a personal, individual level. In 2 weeks from today, on October the 10th, I will offer my thoughts on what's the difference when it comes to how we see and relate to the world of people and events and history around us. Next Sunday, which is the Sunday in between the two, and I hope that you will invite friends, family, co-workers, persons whom you believe lives, this congregation could also make a difference in. I hope you'll invite them next Sunday. I've invited two of our members, Carol Wood, Steve Ledoux, to speak to how they answer this question for themselves. I have long felt the best way we have of introducing ourselves as a religious community to others is to have some of us speak to how a part of being a part of this community has made a difference in their lives. I do that on the assumption that many of those who come here seeking us out are seeking some kind of difference in their lives as well. Otherwise, why not just stay home? Well, more often than not, when we set out to answer this what's the difference question, we do so sometimes in terms of how being a Unitarian Universalist or a religious liberal is different from other religious faiths, like, say, the one we have to be raised in. And that's okay as far as it goes, but it really doesn't go very far. It doesn't go far enough. For just being an ex-Baptist, Catholic, Methodist, or whatever, doesn't really offer a whole lot of sustenance and nurture over the long run of one's life. So I'm looking to get beyond that type of what's the difference answer. Like the artistic consciousness, I believe that a spiritual or religious consciousness is one that allows a person to see something sacred, or something holy, or something different, contained within as well as beyond the ordinary. And I believe there are a certain set of assumptions or beliefs, if you will, that can undergird this way of looking at and experiencing reality. And I want to cover these beliefs, or the ones I have come to anyway, by citing a couple of questions posed in a quite provocative essay that was recently put out by one of my colleagues in the Unitarian Universalist Ministry, Reverend Davidson Lehr, minister of the First Unitarian Church of Austin, Texas, Reverend Dave Lehr, L-O-E-H-R. I say his essay is provocative. It's part of an address he gave at a UU gathering someplace, saying, is Unitarian Universalism dying? As he seems to think it is. Well, that's attention-grabbing, to be sure. Reverend Lehr is a very intelligent, articulate guy, but I'm not going to take on the content of his piece today, other than to say that his basic point, as quickly and best I can determine it, is he strongly believes in religious liberalism. He just doesn't want to call it Unitarian Universalism. There's a website for the Austin, Texas UU Church. If you want to go and check it out, you can read the whole thing there. And for all the arguing I might want to do with my friend Dave Lehr, however, I was in strong agreement with him when he said that there are two basic faith-related questions for religious liberals today. They are, first, what is worth believing? And second, are there deep and abiding truths capable of sustaining honest spiritual quests without supernatural underpinnings? I especially like the order in which these questions are posed. The first one is, what is worth believing? Not what is intellectually defensible or what stands the test of reason or rationality, but what is worth my believing in? Answer that one first. then turn to and put it to the standard or the test of the second. Do these beliefs, these tenets I find worth believing in, sustain and help me in an honest spiritual quest or on a meaningful life journey without relying upon some idea or concept of the supernatural? Those two questions. I'm sure each one of you can run with them pretty well. I'm going to share with you for a few minutes now where they take me, even as I encourage you to go a few rounds with them yourself. And when I look at this, I find I came up with what I'm calling my five worthy beliefs.